Hi, I'm Jay Mitchell, and welcome to another episode of the Big Wave Podcast. Today, we have none other than legendary Hawaiian waterman Mark Healy on the show. Mark's one of my favorite human beings. I've done many a trip with him. He's such a good guy to be on the road with, and we talk about everything from spearfishing to growing up on the North Shore, hunting, being a stuntman. Yeah, we got into a lot of cool stuff, so I hope you enjoy the podcast. Thanks. Mark Healy. Just doing the runner from the family into his car, away from construction, Home Depot runs. It's all happening. I'm going to start with this insane intro, but like, I think the first thing I wanted to say is congratulations as a father. You made the year, mate. You
thanks,
got through
man.
It. I saw Rella.
When
was it? It's gone fast, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's like fast, slow. It's like the longest and shortest year of your life. It's hard to explain. But yeah, successfully raised offspring for a year. It's quite the feat, I'm realizing.
It is quite the feat. And how, just kicking into that, how's it been? How is fatherhood? How are you and Kim handled it? I mean, it's a massive transition, man, from like footloose, fancy free, traveling the world whenever you want to just changing diapers and wiping shitty butts.
Yep, pretty much. It's a new game. We both were ready for it to happen, which I think is a big factor in it. Maybe when it's a surprise and you're 21 years old, it could be a little more confusing. But yeah, it's no joke. It's not easy. We're lucky. Our little girl, she sleeps pretty well and everything. But you hear all those stories, right, from people who have kids, like, you know, oh my God, they're not sleeping so well this week or that. And you're just like, in one ear, out the other, or like, they really got to go down for their nap right now. And you're like, come on, are you just being drama? Like, do they really need to go down at this time when they're tired? And it's like, you realize all that stuff is true. And I feel bad for every time I thought my friends were just being drama. I'm like, oh God, now I know. You will pay for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the best thing in the world. But, so I'm going to read this little paragraph to start off with. Mark Healy is a legendary and intrepid big wave surfer, free diver, spear fisherman, conservationist, skydiver, bow hunter, yoga practitioner, photographer, filmmaker, and Hollywood stuntman. He has devoted his life to the sea, in doing so becoming one of the world's foremost professional watermen.
I probably put a few of those things in different order. There's a lot more bow hunting than skydiving going on these days, but
yeah. But that is. I mean, I got that from your Healy Water Ops website. But that's a pretty cool intro. I mean, I think we all know that you do a multiple handful of things. But I want to go back to the start. I want to go back to growing up on the North Shore, how that love affair started for the ocean for you. I've heard stories about your dad throwing you off the jump rock at Waimea and some stuff like that. But I'd love to hear it from you. You know, like just that being born here, growing up here, and just the sort of the progression from just, you know, being that little white kid to just being one of the best professional watermen in the world.
Yeah, so I was lucky. I got to be born or put on this planet on the North Shore of Oahu, which is a great place to be and also a great place to grow up. It was a different place back then. Not much money. Everybody was pretty broke back then. Lots of empty fields and where there's a ton of houses now. Like, I used to go and catch grasshoppers when I was a kid, and that whole chunk of Sunset Point where you live now, like there was just so many like empty fields and stuff. And it was just having that community and having a lot of other Groms your age and guys a bit older than you, always down at the beach. You always had a place to go to, like, and go for a surf and have people to hang out with. So I feel like the difference between growing up on the North Shore, whereas a lot of other places kind of like the hub for kids and young people is at school. You're supposed to learn all your socializing there and everything. Out here, it's like all the ocean. that's where the bulk of your like socializing and figuring out who your buddies are and all that stuff, it all happens down at the beach. And it was just really nice to have that outlet.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty hard not to be a part of the, you know, have the ocean be a massive part of your life, especially if you are on the North Shore. I mean, you'd basically have no friends. You'd be a loner if you didn't like do something. You know, obviously you do have a school, and that's changing now with homeschooling and stuff. But I mean, back then, really no such thing. I mean, everyone went to school, and you know, then I'm sure that everyone just went straight to the water. That's where you guys lived.
Yeah, pretty much. It seemed to be like in our little neighborhood at Sunset Point, and I lived more on the Velsey Land side on the other side of Cam Highway. But anyways, most of the kids, it was kind of like, it seemed like most of the parents were said, once you're 12 years old, you can go to the beach by yourself. And so you get on your bike and you go meet up with everybody and you have that outlet. So I think that plays a big factor into, you know, pretty much everybody was broke. Like we had rugs in the floor of our house because there was holes there. Like you had to warn people before you came in, like you'll fall through the floor of the house if you step on this rug, like booby trap. but being that you like have this amazing access and like a bunch of people to hang out with, and you got this beautiful wild ocean in front of you, you never felt like you were poor, which was cool.
Yeah, and they say you're a product of your environment and your friends, you know. So, I mean, your parents as well. So, I imagine that you're a little bit, you know, everyone can enjoy the ocean, everyone can love going to the beach, but then there's certain kids in the neighborhood that are that, like, oh, yep, there goes that crazy guy at the, you know, whatever he's going to do, or there those crazy kids hanging out together. Like, when did that start for you? Like, was it like hanging? Because Makua said that you guys used to go spearfishing out the front of his house and all that sort of stuff, but like who was it like growing up? And like I know, like you said, like your dad, like obviously your dad, you know, your dad love the ocean, obviously maybe your mom as well. Like when did it start to click in that like, hey, this is something I'm really gonna sink my teeth into?
I think I just always enjoyed it, because from my earliest memories, like my dad was just dragging me along as a very young kid, like whether it's spearfishing or taking me out surfing or go lua fishing off the beach all night and I walk across the street to school in the morning smelling like a campfire. Yeah. Like I was just always on those trips with my dad. So it kind of it was always a part of my life, but I guess that endless potential of like, well, I've never been out to Sunset Point before. You know, I've been surfing shores all my life. Then I moved up to Val's. Then, oh, maybe we'll get the guts together to go surf Sunset Point. Like with the ocean, it's endless. Like there's still so much stuff like that in my mind. Like it'll keep you going forever.
Yeah. And then what came first for you? Like going to school and then, you know, obviously you're surfing, fishing, diving, all that stuff, but was there a moment in time that you thought, you know, this is, you know, I want to be a professional surfer, or, you know, like where were you in the relative, like in skill level to the people that you were hanging out with? Was it something that like, you were just like, hey, that like most of you, like you said, most of the people have no money out here, like opportunities are maybe a little slim, but what I do see is the best surfers come in here every year and all these amazing watermen, like just that are just, you see them even now this day. I just saw Roger Erickson go past my house. You know what I mean? Like they're just constant, like people just around that obviously would like be like, man, I want to fucking be like that guy. That guy's gnarly. You know what I mean?
I think there's a couple of things. I didn't ever expect to be a professional surfer. I didn't think it wasn't like a goal as a child. I did a lot of organized sports, like playing soccer and track and wrestling and gymnastics and all kinds of stuff like that. So I did have like regular sports, and I always took school seriously and I got really good grades. So I just assumed that I would go to college and, you know, become a marine biologist or something. And then I started getting sponsors. I was never as technically good as any of my friends, really. I never won contests. You know, contests were just beating my head against the wall most of the time, but I just kept doing it because I was too stubborn to stop. But yeah, that was never, it didn't not look like an apparent route for me. And then actually, because back then too, it was like you get one surfboard a year and it's your combined Christmas and birthday present, because my birthday is in December. So it's like one board a year. So now you start like surfing waves. And I remember breaking my first board. That was my one board a year, and just being so devastated. And I think I was in, God, I must've been like 13 or something. Big Fred Patachia, who recently passed, great guy. And, I think this was really a big influence on me pursuing it, is he kind of saw me surfing bigger waves and I didn't have boards, and he had Hawaiian Surf at the time in a surf shop in Haleiwa, and he sponsored me and he got me a couple of surfboards, and I was like, wow, this is, I can keep doing this, you know? Yeah. And fast forward some years later, I got picked up, or God, some years, I'm really bad with years, but anyway, I might've been 12 when Big Fred picked me up. And then around 13 or late 13 into 14, Rusty picked me up. And I remember every time that I had to do a report on any country in school, I'd always pick Fiji. I was always fascinated with Fiji. I would order all the books. I read every book on the island in the library system about Fiji. And I just thought it sounded like this amazing place, like Hawaii must have been, you know, 100 years earlier, and just a really interesting culture and everything. And fast forward to, I get picked up by Rusty and they have their Tavarua trip they do every year, and they invite me. And so at that point I was like, all right, I'm doing exactly what I want to do, do with my life right now. Why would I change that? I was like, you know what? Yeah. College is going to go on the back burner. I'm going to see where this goes. And then I went and had the most amazing week at Tavarua. Absolutely loved it. And the Fijian people and the big left barrels and fish all over the place. And it was coming to the end of the week and everybody's packing up. And I was just like so devastated that I was leaving, that I just did a Hail Mary. All my stuff was packed on the beach to put in the boats. And I ran into the office, and it was Rick Isabella at the time who was managing. And I was like, can I please stay? And I'll work. I'll do whatever jobs need to be done. And he let me stay on the floor of the Boatman's Beret. And I stayed another week and just worked on the island, and then worked with the boatman and did all that. And I made sure that my flight was leaving already to Hawaii before I called my parents to tell them. So I didn't want them to tell me to, like, get your butt on that flight over there. Like, hey, I'm not coming home. I had a mohawk. I was just staying. Lord of the Flies.
And so that was, and that was, I'm guessing that's how that experience with becoming the boatman that you still, I'm not sure if you do it too much these days, but you did a lot throughout the past, right? You would go and spend 2, 3, 4 weeks on your wassail, and all the guys used to go and, you know, do a stint there every year.
Yeah, it was really good times. Back then it was just like, you know, a feral little boat shed, and you're the new young boatmen, so you're taking the early shifts almost all the time. And they used to have a day, this is back before the reefs were all opened up to everybody, and they would have a day in between groups coming in and out of Tavarua where anybody could come in and sign a waiver and pay to go surf cloud break. So being the young boatman, you always got stuck with that one too, because it's like anybody off of the street comes out, and there's these guys that are like, this is my one window to surf cloud break, no matter how big or small it is. And they're frothing and usually can't surf very well. So you got to make sure they don't die, but, just a lot of fun.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. And this is hard for when you grow up on the North Shore, obviously there's big waves all the time, but when did you start to really, progress? Like, I'm guessing Big Sunset, you know, Pipe became a major focus for you, and then, you know, obviously, you know, Waimea, Outer Reefs, blah blah blah. But when did you get that little urge and like man, I really, really love the bigger stuff?
Well, we were always kind of pushing, like Jamie Sterling was like my wingman, and Jamie Sterling charged, and we are super competitive with each other, and we're always like pushing each other. And yeah, it was kind of incremental. I remember the first time surfing Pipeline, it was myself, Jamie O'Brien, Danny Fuller, and Jason Federico, and it was all of our first time surfing Pipe. And that was an eye-opener because we camped on the beach as opposed to staying up at Jamie's house, because we thought that would get us out earlier in the morning, because we were like terrified of like the gnarly guys that surfed out there. We're like, we have to get out there in the dark and we'll have a little window. Yeah. So that was an interesting one. And then I remember there's one year, there's a great photo of Jamie Sterling, and he's airdropping on this solid wave at Waimea, and it was when we were in our early teens, and I had broken my eardrum a few days before, and this swell came, and it, you know how it is when you're progressing and you're at that point, you're mm-hmm. like, I think I'm ready. Now all I need is a swell. For you to yeah. miss that swell is like crushing. And then your buddy goes out and just sends it and like blows people's minds. So I remember I went fishing with my uncle that day, and everyone was surfing Waimea, and I was getting screamed at by him and trying to drive the boat while he's trying to gaff a marlin by himself out at sea in these big swells. And I come in and I just scared Jamie's like, I got a crazy wave. And I just remember just being like, oh my God, I just got lapped. The world's over. I'm just a has-been. And I think that just like really put a fire into my ass. Like not only missing it and being more hungry, but also seeing like Jamie do it. That was like, yeah well, I can do it. We can do it.
Yeah, it's such a good to have a sparring partner like that. You know, like I do remember like when I was living in Australia, and you know, we just as a kid over there, all you do is see the surf magazines, right? Like we have the, you know, obviously a lot of surf mags back in those days, but you know, when all the Hawaiian editions would come out and you just see everything Hawaii, you'd just be like, oh my God. And I remember seeing a bunch of those photos, man, as a kid, you know, as well. And I do remember Sterls and yourself, but what a great guy to have to, and then Sterls is still doing it today too. God bless him. You know yep. what I mean? Like obviously without, you know, times have changed without the sponsors and all that, but mm-hmm. you know, still see him out there on all the big days, and that must have been cool. So when did the free diving and stuff come around too? Like was it the same stage? Like is everything sort of just progressing at the same stage? Because you're surfing bigger waves, you're starting to catch bigger fish, you're just like everything's starting to like ramp up incrementally, like with everything you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was at the same stage. So at the same time, because I remember specifically the yellow life jacket that my dad would put on me when he was taking me surfing was the same one he put on me dragging me behind his dive float when he's diving. So it free diving, spear fishing, and surfing were all in the same vein as far as my development and everything. And they both kind of had like interesting similarities in that Jamie was the only guy my age that was like sending it at that time. Like I could count on him. Otherwise you're either with older guys or you're on your own kind of thing. Whereas the diving, I dove a lot with my dad. My dad works construction and carpentry, so like he can't just go all the time. And you know, you get hungry and you just want to go and go and go. So there was an interesting period probably from like 12 years old to 15 where I almost only dove by myself. So I learned a lot just on my own without guidance and just putting the pieces together. And then I made a couple of good dive buddies out of Haleiwa, because that's how like kid times it was. Like if you're a Sunset kid, the Haleiwa kids, you might see them surfing or whatever, but if they didn't surf and you guys weren't on the same soccer team, you didn't know each other. You didn't see each other a lot. So like I ended up finding some good dive buddies in Haleiwa and started diving with people and doing some tournaments and stuff like that. And yeah, it's just been kind of a natural progression.
Progression, yeah. And then like with the surfing, you know, Sterls is obviously your right-hand man, like you said, but then when you started to go to the next level, the XXL level, like outer reefs mm-hmm. and stuff, you know, who were you looking up to back then? Like who were those older guys that you saw? And then also who were your wing? Like I know you surfed a lot with Wassel on the outer reefs and stuff like that. So who, like in that time frame from like going from, hey, I'm 14 surfing Waimea to like, okay, like now I'm deciding to go to like, you know, Himmies or whatever it may be, you know, and and go to that next level. Who are your right hand men there?
Well, that was an interesting point because that was like a real intersection in surfing right there. That's when the tow craze was like at its peak, right? So basically we would tow sometimes, but also I was like, I don't want to tow on days where I think I can paddle, you know. I feel like it's far more of a challenge to paddle, and I think there's way more room for improvement out there, and it's just kind of like it's easy to neglect because that room for improvement is going to come at such a price and be so difficult. So I kind of like stuck to my guns a lot and would paddle out to these outer reefs, and you got like 10 guys running you over in the lineup and like, will drop in on you towing, and you're trying to paddle out there. And it was this total mess. It was like chaos. And some of these people like can't even surf. And you'll paddle out and they'll be like running you over and telling you you're in the way. And you're like, you wouldn't even say this at Rocky Point, but you got a jet ski and you think you're the man now. So I think through that process of kind of like sticking to what I really wanted to do, I saw the other people who did, you know, Wassel would do that. And then I met Cole on Outer Reefs and Nick, his brother, and Dusty and their whole crew. So that was like the Hawaii kind of group where you hopefully organize and see each other on Outer Reefs. Mike Stewart would be out on the Outer Reefs paddling a lot too, on his bodyboard, of course. And then I ended up doing a trip to Tasmania and meeting Rusty and Greg Long. And I didn't even, again, like this is pre-social media and everything, so I didn't realize there's actually other guys my age that were super hungry on the paddle side still. And just finding big waves. And once I hung out with them for a couple weeks in Tasmania, we became friends and just started hopping on those missions. And Greg was like the master organizer of all that stuff.
Yeah, it seemed like that were the real golden years of like the real just where it just went gangbusters with like jumping on a plane, going to places, really hunting. Because even now, when I look at it now, I don't see like, you know, there's a certain spots people go and post up in Nazaré for 2 months, or people come to Hawaii, but it nearly seems like it's slowed down the crew that would like just jump on a, like if it's 50-50, you're going. If it's 30% going to be good, you're still going. You just didn't want to miss anything. And you're going Jaws, then you're going to Mavericks, and you're chasing down the Todos. And it's just like, you know, it's exhausting. And it's when you're younger, you can pull that stuff off. But it doesn't seem like there's that intention at the moment. I mean, there's multiple ways why that's happening, you know, the finance and sponsors. And I think there's a lot less money, you know. But I think those times you guys had were probably like the golden years, you know?
Yeah, it was. I think for sure big factors are you have time and you don't have a lot of overhead in your life yet and responsibility, because we never were getting paid very much money. So everything was like, yeah, you're chasing these rainbows as far as like a 40% chance at getting a new wave that's never been surfed. But you still, it's very palpable within the group, if it doesn't work out, the loss that we're going to take. You know, of sending an invoice to a sponsor and then being like, well, nothing came out of it, so we're not paying this. And you're like, well, that was, you know, $3,500 in the hole. Like, that's like 2 months of my salary history. So there is that aspect of it. But, and I think, you know, Greg, at least from my perspective, being at the forefront of a lot of this exploration, a lot of the low-hanging fruit isn't around anymore, man. It's going to take more time. It's going to take more resources to go and get these new spots. It just gets more and more difficult.
Yeah. It's you know, even, yeah, Greg slowing down. Yeah, it's the way it is. Yeah, responsibilities. It's a bitch.
Yeah, and it wears you out, man. It's like, I just remember, well, I realized like I had to stop really taking big risks on my trips back to back to back, as far as like, okay, we're going to South Africa up the West Coast and maybe there's a wave. You know, you do all that travel and if you don't score, that stings. But then if you do that on the next trip and the next trip, it's like your endurance for it just gets crushed. And I feel like you get this fatigue that just sticks with you, to where, I've come around more to the approach that Shane Dorian's always had. And it's like, be targeted and really pick your moments and be at your best when you are having those opportunities.
Yeah. I remember talking to you not long ago about the whole Mavs thing. Cause I mean, I can't even remember how many times we all did surf Jaws and jump on a red eye, and then Mavs is bombing the next day and you're like, no sleep, you beat up from Jaws. And then all of a sudden you're just going 5-4-3, booties, hood, gloves, and you're paddling out the Mavs going, what the hell am I doing? Like, you know, and I think I remember you saying that you won't do that anymore. Like you won't, it's okay. Like, I think you were saying you won't really do that anymore. Like you won't do that mission. Like unless it's a swell where it's not really good in Hawaii and you can get to Mavs and you can actually have that preparation to go, you know, it's not really worth it.
Yeah. I think a big part of that is, as you would know, when you're around long enough, you realize things do go bad. And when you realize things go bad and you're around things going bad, not only do you know it can happen and it can happen to anybody, it makes you think back at how many times you were that close to it going really bad before. And it's a numbers game. It's like, it doesn't matter who you are. If there's a certain aspect or a big aspect of big wave surfing that is uncontrollable, and you have to be at peace with that. Like you can prepare everything. Well, you just take one weird hit and it's all gone. So it's like, yeah, it's difficult to win the lottery, but when you buy 2 billion tickets, your odds go up quite a bit. You're exposing yourself over and over.
Yeah. And you take you look at some wipeouts that other guys take and girls, and you're like, and yourself, and you go, how am I still got my limbs and my head still attached? And then you take another one that's like, why is my neck so sore? Why did I crank my thing on that? Like there's no rhyme or reason. It's just, like you say, it's, you do it enough soon enough that it's going to come back to bite you. And I think, you know, for me as well these days, it's like the need to be in the water 8 hours a day and to chase that is not quite like it used to be. And I'm a lot happier with a lot less, you know, like one, you know, sometimes one or two wave is good anyway, like in the best of days, but like even that now looks a lot more enticing than it used to, you know. Being, if I go out and have one or two nice waves, it's like, that was a good session, especially if you come in feeling good and be able to surf next week.
Yeah. And to me, like the most exciting part about big wave surfing is knowing where you're at and what you haven't done yet and trying to pursue that. So whether it's stuff like, you know, get a giant proper barrel at Mavs Left, like a proper one, you know, there's still that's out there to be had. Whereas I'll trade 100 waves for that one that's my goal that pushes me and pushes the sport in general. So it's worth making those decisions once you start distilling like what you really want to get out of the experience.
Yeah. And then you got to look at the swells too. You're like, well, it's going to be too big for the left. Am I feeling good? Am I going to go? And then you go and hurt yourself, right? Like like you said about Jamie and Waimea. And then all of a sudden a week later, that perfect swell comes that the left's going to be like 15 to 18 feet barrel. And that, now you're out of the water. So that chance to do what you wanted has been taken away from an egotistical probably mindset, you know, because let's be honest with ourselves. We've all got, you know, the big wave guys, a lot of ego, a lot of freaking ego. Whether you want to admit it or not, we're all pretty egotistical and in our own weird ways, you know. But once you get close to 40, I feel like that's, you know, on coming on the lowdown a little more. You know, we'll let the young kids or you know, Lucas and Kai and all those guys take that to the next level.
Yeah, exactly. And I swear, like, just getting into bow hunting I've learned some interesting lessons just watching animals and bow hunting that kind of like reinforced the way I was starting to think already, because it's like there's a reason why a big buck in an area that has a lot of people coming into it is going to get big. And it's because he doesn't do things as completely as the other bucks do, you know? So whereas like when we're younger, we're doing like, you just want now, more, keep going. Like, whether it's like just because you're crazy with just like the excitement of it or an ego thing or whatever. Whereas like, and I always think like bucks in the rut. So oftentimes like in Hawaii, we're going into the axis deer rut at the moment. And what happens is male deer do stupid things during the rut. That's your best opportunity to take a big buck because they're not thinking about their safety as much as they are about fighting and breeding, which is like a young man, basically. And that's when the big ones fall. But there's ones that have been through year after year after year. And you know what the difference is you can watch them and they'll stop. And they want to continue on, maybe chasing a hot doe or something like that. And you just see them look around and kind of take a different path. They're like, oh, that's how that thing has survived so long. He does something just a little different from the rest, and he's not quite as compulsive. I was like, maybe I need to be more like that big buck.
Yeah.
Before I get myself killed.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I definitely want to encourage the young kids to keep being young bucks, because I really love watching it, you know, and we all done it, right? So how can you say don't do it? It's like, evolution. So
yeah, choose your own adventure. Just try to make the best decisions you can and mitigate the risk as much as you can for the people around you and yourself. I guess that's all you can do.
Yeah. Yeah. And what does going into bow hunting, you just mentioned it, how much you're getting out there these days? You know, with everything that's going on in the world, are you been able to go slay some food, or is it sort of slowed up?
No, I haven't gotten to go out. I've been super busy, but also on Oahu, you got pigs and goats, neither of which I'm like giant fans of eating. So I don't really hunt on Oahu that much anymore. I kind of started out hunting here and with pigs, and then you realize like, wow, I got a lot of pork to eat. So I usually go outer island to go hunt axis deer. They're amazing eating, and it's like some of the most challenging, like spot and stalk bow hunting. So basically creeping around and hiding and on your feet, not just staying in a tree stand or anything like that. So super challenging. It's one of the healthiest red meats on planet Earth. I think it's got one of the highest in protein and lowest in fat profile of any red meat. So they've all had like a wild, diverse diet. So it's really healthy food, and I just love getting out there. And it's kind of like that big wave thing. You'd be amazed how much adrenaline and how nervous you are when it comes down to it, when you have to take that shot. And because it's with archery, it's so much about fine motor skills. I realized that I could be like shaking nervous and surfing big waves if it's like a really crazy day and still function, because it's kind of like basic movements. There's not a lot of fine motor skills involved in surfing a wave, but when you have to have your hand totally still in a smooth release like this and not be shaking, and you can see your heartbeat, like when it's pounding, it's affecting your stability. So it kind of like, it doesn't let you lie to yourself and think like, Oh, no, I wasn't that nervous. You're like, oh my God, it's on right now. And there's real repercussions if I screw this up. And so I like that mental aspect of it, trying to control that.
Yeah, I was going to say there must be a lot of parallels to the hunt, because I've never hunted, so I have no idea, but I'm guessing, like you just said, there's got to be like a lot of takeaways from what you do in the water and big waves and even diving probably to the hunting, you know, like you said, it's like deep breaths, relax, calming yourself, getting that heart rate down to make the best shot or the best decision. It seems like there's a lot of things you can take away from both to take into both sports.
Yeah, and the consequences are high in both, and you don't forget when you've messed it up. So it's like,
yeah,
it's not just like, oh well, bummer, you know, like if you wound an animal and it doesn't die fast, you feel horrible about that. You never ever forget it. So it's like, that's most of the pressure, is just trying to be as humane as possible. But to be humane and get this meat, you have to control your emotions and your adrenaline. So it's like this crazy dichotomy. It's weird. It's like as soon as that animal comes out, everything changes. Like you're normal, you're totally fine, and then all of a sudden it's like this
game on.
Really, yeah, like deep core primal, almost fight or flight kind of thing, because you know it's like something is potentially going to live or die right now, and you got to function within that.
Yeah, like I said, I've never done it, but it seems like it's another thing to get addicted to, right?
Yeah, and for me, like, I've always got my own fish, always stayed pretty close to the community as far as a lot of the food that we've eaten, whether it's friends that have farms or backyard farms or whatever it is, and red meat was always a big blank spot for me. And I remember watching that documentary Food Inc., which was one of the early documentaries that really went over our food system and how broken it is, and learned about all that aspect to it. And I felt like, well, I don't put this on other people, like, I don't feel like I should eat red meat if I can't do the job myself and really see the cause and effect. Like, an animal lost its life to feed me this food. I need to at least have the respect to go and do that. I don't enjoy doing that by any means, but so there's that aspect. And then just really eating like as clean of meat as possible and just having a better diet. And another thing that kind of opened my eyes, I was staying in the Tuamotu spearfishing. And again, I went with a friend who spoke French and Pomotu as well. He was there for a week. I liked it there. I stayed. Nobody spoke English. My French is non-existent. But anyways, I was helping the dad with dinner and chores and stuff around the place. And we caught a rooster and killed it and was defeathering it, helping him out with everything. And I just remember cleaning this rooster and then eating it and just thinking, that is so crazy how different that looks from the chicken breast fillets I see on a store shelf. And it made me start asking questions. I'm like, wait, what does real food look like? What does real natural food look like? How does it look like that on a shelf when it hasn't been in nature? Like, what does it take? What amendments, what things do you have to stick into this animal to get a piece of meat looking like that when it hasn't lived an active life and had a diverse diet? Like, you're making up for that somehow. So that was the other kind of reasoning and way of thinking that led me to bow hunting.
Yeah, cool. I want to lead into the spear fishing, because you love it, you do it all the time, but you got right into the contest there for a while too. I keep coming back to Wassel, but I think you guys went to WA too at some stage for a contest, but you won a Pan American contest or something like that. But I mean, there was a stage where you were, did you like sort of like jump in like deep into that game as well, just to see what it was like, instead of just sort of doing it for the, like, to just feed the family sort of thing?
Yeah, well, I wanted to just get pushed. I wanted to like become a better free diver and have like be forced to do that, you know, through competition. Another really interesting part of it is going to a place that you've never been in the world, and you have to learn the behaviors of like 20 or 30 different fish species that are eligible to be taken during the event. And you got to find where they are all within like 10 days. And you're competing against people who, it's like somebody competing against me diving the North Shore. Like they've lived there their whole life. They've qualified through highly competitive qualifications. So it's like this crazy challenge. And I kind of wanted to, for a long time, try to go to the World Championships and put in a good effort there. But yeah, I never ended up doing that because it was just like the surfing thing. And you have to qualify based on two different nationals results to be on the USA team for the world. And they started running, like every other United States championships in like lakes, shooting carp and stuff. And I just didn't have a lot of interest in doing that at that time and spending 2 weeks scouting in a lake. So I never really did that, but I did other competitions and did pretty well in some, and it was interesting, but, I don't really do tournaments anymore. I would be very selective if I did it. It would really be based on the fish species list, because I think some of the tournaments like that I saw, you just, so many fish got killed just to, you know, compete in a tournament. Yes, it goes to food banks and charities and stuff like that, but still, I was like, one of the turning points on that was actually, I did a tournament, I won't say what country or whatever, but a place that has really good fisheries rules in place and pretty strict ones in general. And I remember, because the people hosting the tournament will give everybody a breakdown, like, okay, this fish had minimum size, this many centimeters, blah, blah, blah. This is its life cycle and habits. And then one of the fish was, they're like, yeah, and this fish, and it's a fish only like this big. And they're like, yeah, when they're this size, they're about 35 years old. And I'm like, what? Are we going to go kill a bunch of fish that managed to live 35 years with things trying to eat it every day just to try to win a tournament? Like, that is wrong. They're going to kill something older than me to try to, for my ego here. And I didn't shoot any in that tournament. I could have, and it definitely affected our placing, but I was like, I just don't feel right about this. I'm not going to eat it. We don't have time. You do the tournament and then all day, and you're staying in like a place with a little kitchen. Like, the odds of us actually eating that fish are so low. Like, somebody else is going to eat it, but whatever. I could have shot a fish that reaches maturity at 2 years old that probably tastes similar and not take that one out of the ecosystem there. So that kind of like made me step back from competition too. I was like, I don't know. It's all ego.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's crazy. So I want to sort of move on into like just training, what you're doing these days. I mean, obviously you just live a real active lifestyle. And I think, and I want to say too, just like, I think, you know, your mental ability, the mental state is probably like nearly all the training, you know, sometimes what people need. But, you know, did you ever get right in? Were you ever like, I mean, I know you're not right into a lot of like training, like going to the gym style training, but like at your peak, you know, in those 20s when you were really hustling for waves, like what was Mark Healy's training regimen like? And like, I just want to get into your like psychological, like, you know, physiology about it, you know, like, was it more mental for you? Was it more physical? Was it a combination of both? Like, what made Mark Healy tick and still be sitting here talking to me today?
Yeah, it's the mental aspect is huge. Getting good physical fitness was never hard for me. I just got lucky. But I would stay very consistent. So I'd be surfing a lot. I'd go body surf a lot in between surfs. I feel like body surfing is an amazing workout. And then I would do different training things, whether it was going up to the boar's nest or, you know, doing beach runs, things like that. I was training with Kid with his gymnastica stuff, Kid Peligro. And a lot of stuff here and there. I'd do gym time as well. But I always had a hard time with all the travel and leaving last minute to stay on like, okay, I'm going to the gym and doing these workouts like super consistently, because it was always like, all right, I'm getting on a plane, I'm out of here. So and I like to be outdoors. I like actually doing the things, and that's a thing, is like, if you're a professional surfer, it affords you the time to be able to, like, your training be actually doing the things that you would be training for. So that was kind of my theory. These days I'm diving a lot. I've actually been benched for like over a month now after this last streak of late season pipe swell. So I'm almost normal again. And, I definitely want to get back to working out more. I've been doing some swims and beach runs, but that's about it.
What did, I mean, a lot of people listening to this are going to be like, you know, in the craziest situations, you know, you've put yourself in, like, what is the first thing that comes to Mark Healy's mind? Like, is it like stay calm? You know, do you have a little system that you go through, that, you know, gets you through that initial, like, holy shit moment. This is going to be like next level bad.
Yeah. So, it's almost like I'm already, as soon as I know it's going sideways, I'm already starting to kind of shut down the peripheral and go on like brain life support, basically. So as I'm on my way, it's almost as if you're passing a sign jogging in the direction of meditation. And the sign is like, what can I control right now? And I quickly just kind of do the math, like, okay, I can only control, you know, I have buoyancy, I'll eventually go up. I can control using as little muscle as possible without things ripping out of socket. I can control my mind, and then I just dig into my mind. And I stay there until I start coming up.
It's funny because it's
a battle.
Yeah.
It's like two dogs fighting each other in there.
I remember Ross Clark Jones saying he just used to, you know, he was typical Ross Clark, but he would just say, I just would think I was at a party and I was just dancing with a bunch of hot chicks. That's where his mind would go to.
So that does sound very Ross Clark Jones.
I just been a nightclub and I'm dancing, and then all of a sudden I come to the surface. I'm like, right on, Ross.
That's kind of like that Happy Gilmore where he's like having the dream. He's got like a little guy brings him a pitcher of beer and there's like women around. It's a big part of it though is what I've already thought about and what I've prepared for. So it's like the bulk of that I've already taken care of, from whether it be a situational standpoint, potential situations, potential threats, hazards. How I thought it out, what I think my outs are as far as something going bad. So I've already really, there's a process of thinking about that before you get into that place that allows me to only focus on my mental space when I need to. So I need to have some real concrete evidence in my view that I am okay going to that mental place. Like there are certain steps that help me to be okay with just being at that.
Yeah, I think everything comes down to preparation, you know, preparation of everything. So moving on to that, I guess going to like to let's talk about Healy Water Ops. I mean, seems like everything we've spoken about already sort of just that's what's been put into, you know, your company Healy Water Ops. Like you're giving you know, everyday people the chance to come and experience what you've experienced from, it seems like, at such a young age. So tell us a little bit more about Healy Water Ops, what you're doing with that, what it means, who can come and do that.
Yeah, so pretty much it was when I was younger, I remember, and things have changed quite a bit since then, but back in the day, it was like you have these beautiful golf courses in Hawaii at these hotels, and the service is good on the golf courses and all of that. But when somebody comes on their honeymoon to Hawaii, they probably want to go down the beach and in the ocean. And the best offering was like, here's a dirty dive mask and go drown on your honeymoon. Basically, like, there's no acknowledgement to what like the opportunities there were with the ocean. And so it was always in my mind. And I finally started it probably 6 years ago now. And basically taking all that experience and resources, whether you know, and taking these groups of people, whether it's people that I work with that are professional athletes and great coaches, people who are the best in the world at water safety, film production, the scientific community, working with conservation projects and tagging projects and stuff like that, and kind of being able to bring together these customized experiences for people. And I mean, it's not cheap because a lot goes into it, and it truly is one of a kind, and it's different for every single person, and it, that all gets built on conversation that I have with the people leading up to it and group dynamic and all of that. But just my goal is always to be like, after the end of the trip, I want to know that they, no amount of money on planet Earth could have bought that experience that they just had. That's like my goal. Yeah. And like, I stick to it, and in a safe way. So it's a customizable thing. I've worked all over the world, mostly out of country. Whether it be going to clients' yachts and working with their yacht crew and scouting stuff and setting stuff up for when the clients do get in, or maybe it's somebody who just wants a private lessons in like how to become more adequate in the water, whether it's in the free diving or spearfishing or in the surf, anything like that. And then if I don't feel I'm the best person to teach that job, I'll bring somebody in for particular aspects of it. So yeah, it's been super interesting and fun, and it's an awesome racket. I love it. But I do feel bad. People hit me up and a lot, and they're like, "Oh, well, how much does this cost?" I'm like, "Well, it's not cheap. There's a lot of assets and things that go into it." So I do feel bad having to respond to those messages, but it's reality.
Yeah, and it's your whole life. It's a life of lifelong experiences that, like, you know, like 30 years of your life to get to that point, you know, that's got to come at a price, you know. And sometimes I feel like when you do a higher price, you get more work anyway, because people are like, well, why is this guy more expensive than the other guy? It's like, well, there's usually a reason why this guy's more expensive, you know, because he's been around.
And I don't do the haggling stuff. It's on or it's not. I'm totally fine not taking work as well, but you have to look. It's like, you pay an attorney $300 an hour. You know, how many attorneys are out there? There's literally tens of thousands of attorneys. So you want to go and do this stuff in the ocean and create something that people have not done before? How many people can help you achieve that? And I'm not saying like I'm the only guy or something, but it's like to put it into perspective. And I think a lot of people, and that's something that I like wanted to achieve in this, is because I know people like yourself, like obviously in a couple different areas at least, that are like straight up like Beethovens at what they do. And you've been in an industry where you have to, and not to badmouth the industry, like it's given me what I have, but dude, you get nickeled and dimed and you're like, wait a second, how many other people in the world can do this right now? And I gotta haggle for like a $400 board bag fee reimbursement, like I'm selling a used car or something. Like, that doesn't seem right. So that's kind of like the other aspect of it. I think a lot of people who have been really talented in these things that very few are talented in and have really undervalued themselves. And I'd love to give opportunity to some of those people.
Yeah. And then you also do a lot of stunt work too, right? You seems like that's, I mean, a lot of movies come to Hawaii. I obviously love coming here, but what's that like? What's a day in the life of a stunt job like on Oahu?
Yeah, I mean, it depends if it's a feature or a TV show. I actually worked a ton last year. I probably worked a couple of months at least. So I was real busy with stunts. But it's just depending on what your call time is. You show up half an hour early, get in wardrobe. Hopefully your wardrobe's there. Maybe wolf down some food if it's early in the morning real fast, go to hair and makeup. And it really depends on the job. A lot of times you're sitting around a lot. It's like sit around for 6 hours, and then all of a sudden it's like, okay, get up, get thrown through this window, and don't screw it up because we don't have time to reset the window if you don't blow through the window when the bang goes off and all of that. So it's like, okay, stretch. So you're trying to stay limber the whole time, you know, because you never know, because they might switch scenes on the script for efficiency or whatever. So it's kind of like that. And then some jobs are really easy. Sometimes it's like, you just got to jump down from this thing to that thing. And then other times it's like full white knuckle, like you're like full focus, 100% attention. Yeah. You know?
What's the craziest, heaviest moment in your stunt career?
It's probably the only fire one I've actual fire one. Like, I've gotten shot and had squibs more times than I know, but there is a big explosion that we had to go through, and that the fireball ended up being like 90 feet high, and we're in the middle of it, and we're all gelled up, and so you can't see anything. So we're actually carrying a guy who is on a seat. There's three of us carrying a guy who's on a seat, and we're running through a jungle, and it's dark and it's uneven ground. And so because there's only one guy on one side and two on the other, it's kind of like awkward and you can't really see. And when you run past a certain point, they're going to blow these things off like right on us. And the thing is you have to have your eyes closed and you cannot be breathing in when that fireball hits, or you're going to get fucked up. So, and you have to continue running, and it's uneven ground, and so it was pretty crazy, and it was a giant fireball, and I didn't get too hurt. Some people got hurt, but that was one. The escalators are never fun. I've gotten kicked on a couple escalators backwards.
That's not fun.
It's not fun. It's not like a crazy stunt, but it's not fun.
You wake up sore the next day, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I think besides that, it's like just jumping in vehicles that you haven't gotten to drive around yet. Like, something usually you want to try to get a familiarity with the vehicle, and sometimes it's like go, hop in this thing, and you're like, okay, make sure the brakes work, make sure. So, you know, it's always like you're expected as a stunt person to A, be professional, and be able to, you know, the stunt coordinator is going to be really the biggest part of the role and following your stunt coordinator, but you're expected on your own to be able to fill in the blanks a lot. So you got to be able to think on your feet with a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So moving along from the stunt, I'm going to just keep adding this. So for big waves, what's the craziest thing that's happened with you surfing big waves?
Geez.
That one moment when you're like, fuck, this could be it, or it's getting close to it.
There's been a few of those. I think a couple of times when I've broken my eardrum in real big surf, and both times I was exhausted, like way past the time of day that I should still be out. And one of them was the first time I went to Jaws, and it was huge Jaws, and we were towing it then. And yeah, I lost consciousness, but I didn't lose all motor control. And I got real lucky. I came to the surface because that was back before we were wearing vests, and I was with Jamie Sterling, and we had this thin vest, like a Walmart zip up wakeboard vest. And I wasn't even going to use that because I had too much pride. And he's like, just use the thing. So I used it. And it was late in the day. I ended up just getting teed off on right before the West Bowl on one. Landed on my heels. My eardrum blew. And the vest just like ripped in half. And it was coming off my arm. And at the last second, I grabbed it and just held on to it and held it to my chest. And I was just spinning underwater. And then, you know, you're late in the day and super dehydrated, and instantly, like, both quads lock into cramps, both calves lock into cramps, spinning, and just like that, your body is just like a cesspool of lactic acid. And just like, I know, I, because I had broken my eardrum before. Actually, the time I had broken my eardrum before that was years before when I missed out my Maswell that I talked about earlier when Jamie Sterling got a crazy one.
Yeah.
But yeah. And just, I remember like, I, because I know what the feeling of losing consciousness is from free diving and holding my breath on land until I black out. So I'm like, going out. And, I got my mind back together. I pulled myself back in somehow. It was really difficult to do. And then at a certain point, it was just like bright white light. So I had gotten up on the surface and I was in the foam. And that was why it was bright, but I was spinning so hard I couldn't even see. And I did like a little sip and got probably half foam. And then the second one felt like it held me under even longer. And ended up taking like, gosh, this thing. I ended up taking probably 5 waves on the head. Victor Lopez picked me up, grabbed me by the hair. And we're next thing I know, I'm on our jet ski, me and Jamie Sterling jet ski in the channel. And I'm like throwing up because I'm spinning so hard and swallowing it back because I didn't want to throw up in front of everybody and look like a bitch, you know? Like just chugging my vomit back down just because of
no ego.
None at all. But it was funny because like 2 or 3 weeks later, we're at Pipeline, it was firing, we're down at the Quick House down there, and Sean Lopez was there, and he's like, bro, my dad said he picked you up at Jaws and your eyes were like this big, and he grabbed you by the hair and threw you on the sled. I was like, no he didn't, Jamie picked me up. It's like, my dad said it was definitely you. I was like, bullshit. No, it wasn't. I'm like, well, let's settle this right now. And I called Jamie. I'm like, tell Sean you picked me up that day at Jaws. And he's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, wait, what? He's like, I couldn't get you. Victor picked you up. So I don't remember any of that. There's like, I don't know how much time I have no idea what was going on. So I must have been like barely there.
Yeah.
Wow. Just there enough to have your eyes open still. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a close one. And then what about, I know you do a lot of the tagging now with the sharks, right? And you've swum with some big creatures, but what about the free? I always get like, you know, when people say, well, yeah, you know, I can hold my breath for 6 minutes and all this stuff. Like I mean, I've done the free diving course on the Big Island too. And I got to do a static breath hold and, you know, whatever, it was 5 something, but I'm like, but then, you know, like say for example, the wipeout this year, you know, like 30 seconds underwater after, you know, you paddle and get guillotined, right? Like 30 seconds feels like 10 minutes, you know, like, so I've always been under the impression that like training, like just cause you got a 6 minute breath hold doesn't mean you're ready to surf Jaws. Like, as in like, you know what I mean? Like, explain that a little bit, because like I feel like for me, like I remember we used to do, you know, when we were doing some training together and we were like going up and down the with the rock out around the yacht at Waimea and stuff, like stuff, the training like that is so much more like specific to what we're gonna encounter, like wiping out. But so anyway, I mean, a roundabout question, like what would be your, you know, advice to people that are trying to get like a breath hold that's sort of more towards holding your breath, going out to surf big waves, and actually just being able to say, hey, I can hold my breath for fucking 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's there's a few different factors. There's, and I go over this in I just did this online course, so it's like Mark Healy's Guide to Heavy Waters. So I kind of go over this in that. But that's why it's so much a thought process, right? So you have to figure out how to create mental resiliency. A lot of the things that are taught in freediving, which are great, you just, it's a tool set. You just have to use the right tool for the job when it applies to big surf. And a lot of the things that are taught are based on about as controlled an environment as you can have. It's like, spend all that time getting your heart rate low, get as calm as possible, like drown out any other people that are around you. Take your glide, you know, kick down slowly, go through your mental process. It could not be more opposite in big wave surf.
Yeah.
So like, you know, like pressure changes everything. Like, and if you don't have that mental resiliency to to be at peace with not having the say in when you hold your breath or when you get to breathe again, that is a huge factor. That's what really screws people up in the head. Another aspect of it is whereas like, yeah, okay, you can bust out a beast of a static breath hold in a pool or just laying on the bottom, you know, in the ocean. But what does that even say about your ability to process CO2 and lactic acid? Because you're going to have to do this multiple times and you're going to have to do it in succession and you're not going to get all the recovery time that you want in between these things. So your body has to have like a different mechanism. It has to be introduced to like this high CO2 blood chemistry. It has, because your body will adjust and it will adapt to it. But yeah, there's some key differences there.
Yeah. It sounded like exactly what you went through at the Jaws wipeout, you know, the whole that, you know, when you come up and you can barely grab onto a sled because your arms feel like concrete, you've got, there's not like a, you're down to like 2% of energy in that video game. You know, you just got hit so hard, that thing is just drained from 100% to 2% and you're barely hanging on. You know, you start to cramp, you vomit. It's like your body's just basically shutting down.
Yeah. And there's something particularly demoralizing, I feel. About so you know, if you're doing a long static breath hold, you still know in the back of your mind and in the front of your mind actually that you get to choose when you breathe again. And if you're coming up from a super deep dive and you feel like you're really going to run out of gas before you hit the surface, there's a dark, lonely feeling to that too, and it feels kind of like helpless. But there's something about getting beat up while that's happening that just makes it even more demoralizing. It's more personal or something. And I think that's another factor, is like the violence of it. It almost like personifies something that's trying to take your life a bit more.
Yeah.
It feels like even less.
Then you got to worry about the next one and the next one. It's like, it's not ending now. Like, you don't just hit the surface and are floating and someone comes to get you. Like, you sit there and you got another 60 footer and another one and another one. And you can see it like, and even if you're like conscious and you see, like you're seeing everyone looking at you and you're just going, well, there's not a person in the world that's going to help me right now. Like it's crazy.
Yeah. And that goes back to, It's like the art of compartmentalization, like mentally compartmentalizing your experiences, right? So you have to deal with it as it's happening, right? And if you've made a good game plan and you've thought of all the redundancy things that could happen, you don't have to necessarily think three steps ahead in that moment. You can let yourself just deal with that moment. But like that psychological factor, it's like, looking at your watch when you're doing your breath hold, you will never ever hold your breath as long. Or if you're hitting the wall on a run or a swim, that's when you focus on one stroke at a time, one step at a time, and just go back to only a rhythm and being in the moment every single step, instead of looking up and being like, oh my God, I got 10 more miles. It's just so demoralizing. And that's where the compartmentalization helps in those big wave experiences.
Yeah, I think it's like the flow state, right? They talk about where you sort of just get into a mental state of like there's nothingness. It's just pure flow. I remember I've been doing an ice bath at home with my sauna, and as soon as you look at your clock, it's like, what the hell? Why is that? I've got a minute left. Like if you can just sit there and just go into another place, like that time goes fast. But as soon as you start thinking about the time, or it's like it feels like the time's actually messing with you.
And I'm a firm believer that that's a muscle, you know, like you have to work that part of your brain regularly in any, and there's a lot of ways to access that, but you don't want to be forced to try to find that presence and that compartmentalization in a moment where it's life and death, when you haven't been practicing that in a controlled way beforehand.
Yeah.
it's going to be 100 times more difficult for you. And why would you make a, knowing you're going into something that's risky, that could be potentially be life and death, and put yourself at that disadvantage? Yeah, it sucks to do it, and it sucks to get familiar with it. That's why it works. It sucks. You got to go to a place and endure some suffering, but it's taking your medicine, man. Nobody wants to take their medicine. I don't either, Pat. I have to motivate myself to do it. Most times I don't want to do it, but you just force yourself to do it because we've been lucky enough to realize what the consequences are of not doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And seeing friends pass, you know, it's reality. So,
yep.
So what's big wave surfing look for you now? You know, like are you as hungry? Are you, like we talk about later, you're picking, choosing, like say we're moving into 2021, like this coming season, like does Mark Healy still have lofty goals? You know, like getting a massive Waimea left or a Mavs left, like you said, like what's left there to prove to yourself or, you know, to anyone, you know, on the big wave scene for you?
Yeah, there's definitely stuff. But at this point, the stuff is so like swell and conditions dependent to even have the opportunities to do those things. You know where you're going to have those opportunities at the normal, now traditional big wave spots, say, you know, it's like a couple of outer reefs over here, Waimea, Mavericks, Peahi. I haven't made it over to Europe yet for a surf, but I would group in Nazaré with that. So you kind of know, you got a good idea when you're going to have opportunities for those things at those places. Yeah. But now that I'm not like as much feel like I'm missing out if I'm not there with every single person comparing myself to them and trying to stand out, I'd like to use more swells to go follow up on those leads that I've never followed up on yet, just because I've been so busy doing other things, you know, and get back to that exploration and get back to that, you know, that whole experience of, because, you know, we've done the last minute flights to go to Mavericks 8 million times. How many times have we done it to Jaws and all of that? Like, you could keep doing that, or like, I want to go on an adventure, like go back to those like 50-50 odds of scoring a new wave, but it's an amazing experience along the way. That's super interesting to me.
Yeah. Do you think that's got lost a little bit with this new generation? I mean, speaking of the new generation, like what do you think? What are your thoughts on the up and coming kids and what they're doing now, and compared to sort of like when you were a kid, like, is it like, are you, I mean, you're obviously still a fan. I mean, you still, you know, you still surf the contest and you're like, you know, you're obviously like me, you know, who's doing what, but, what's your take on guys like Chumbo and, you know, Kai and like Luca Padua from Mavericks and stuff? Like, they're all, you know, like pushing the limits.
I love it, man.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. That was always my goal. And that's one of the reasons why I stuck with paddle and surfing when it was like, I could have easily lost all my sponsors. Paddle and surfing was not cool. We got lucky that Evan Slater became the editor at Surfing Magazine and he was sympathetic to the paddling cause. Otherwise, I could have lost everything sticking to paddling surfing. But that was one of the reasons why I stuck to it, or one of the main reasons besides personal challenge, was that it's like, I'm getting to live a fantastic life being a professional surfer. What's my contribution? Like, I don't think you should be a part of something unless you're looking to contribute it and at least help in the process of taking it to the next step. So that was kind of always my biggest fear. I was like, I'll be damned if I'm a part of this and it's not going to progress in some way. And my biggest fear was that it would stagnate, really. And it most certainly hasn't, because these young guys are going nuts and they're surfing it with more, I don't know if aggression is the right way to say it, but that's what it is. It's aggression, technical ability. I love watching it.
I'm a big fan. It's like a multi, you know, you see these kids now doing multi-sports and they're taking that multi-sport approach to big wave surfing. And yeah, even with the, I feel like towing is nearly sort of slowly working its way back again, you know, with Nazare and you know, even bit giant jaws again. You know, there are those days where it's just like, man, like no one's catching
waves. It would be better to tow.
You can be towing it again, you know. That's like, and you see the approach and, you know, how, you know, guys are, you know, taking that, those different lines and it's cool. I think it's exciting. I think it's needed. You know, I think we lose the fact that without tow surfing, a lot of the rescue skills that we all got with picking up and learning how to save someone and driving a jet ski, like, you know, I think that's probably one thing that the youth have missed, you know, to sort of like that we, you know, we were able to do that when tow surfing was around. Like, you knew what it was like to go into the pit and pick someone up and, you know, the cavitation and the timing and what you needed to outrun a wave and all that sort of stuff. Like, but I feel like it's coming back, especially now with Nazare, because try and go and drive a jet ski there. It is next
level. It looks so hard.
It is next level. If you want, if you want like to go and get that fucking fear level, go up, just go drive yourself on the ski into the shore break and go, okay, now get yourself back out the back, because it is fucking hectic. It is so hectic.
It looks so radical. I wish I could find this interview, because it was like at least 10 years ago, and it's amazing to see it happen. I said it's going to go all the paddle is going to start hitting a ceiling, and that's when tow-in surfing is going to come back the way it should come back. It like kind of needed to take a hiatus because there was unfinished business with paddle. And I said, you watch, it's going to be more like big mountain snowboarding, and people are going to look back and dig up old footage of guys like Rush Randall and see how ahead of his time he was before. And like Rush is here at my house right now, actually. He's working. Yeah. And I work stunts with him a bunch too, but like, go look at his old footage. He was doing all that stuff, especially like in the like normal size waves, like all the flips and McTwists and everything that Kai's doing now. I think that just seems to be how progression works. It happened with the quad boards. It happens with everything. Like, there's these people who are ahead of their time, and then it gets revisited once like egos and everything and what's considered the trend at the time kind of implode. So like I saw that come in, and when I saw Kai start doing that, I was like, yes, like it's about to get really exciting. Because this is what needed to happen.
Yeah, Rush Randall is a dead set freak. Like, if you the back in the strap crew days, like that guy was, if you talk to a lot of those guys, that guy was maybe the most talented out of the whole group. You know, if you saw what he was doing on a foil board back then, you know, with the snowboard boots and that, like that guy was doing backflips and then even like with the connected surfing, like him and Kalama and stuff, like you say, like at Hokipa, like that was doing surfing with connected and Laird. They were all doing that stuff back in the 90s, you know? I mean, thank God for those guys. Like, you know, that would have been such an insane, like to be all those guys hanging out every day, just tinkering and pushing the limits and coming up with what to do next. Like, must have been one of the greatest periods of like surfing for those guys. It must have been incredible.
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that they like had their own thing and they're generally shunned by the surf world too. As far as like surf brands, no big surf brands sponsored those guys. Like they were just like, we're doing what we want, you know, like we're out. It was a pretty interesting thing, you know, that they had going on there, and definitely a dynamic group. And I don't know. I think one of the most interesting things about big wave surfing is it's probably the most, it's probably got the most progression and equipment and free thinking and people just throwing different ideas at board design or in life-saving and all of this stuff. Like there's so many factors and there's so much tinkering and it's just really fun. Whereas like okay, you got your good, your main shapers have really amazing boards. The guys are winning world titles on short boards, but like, that's about it. It's not reinventing the wheel. Whereas you got some wild stuff happening on the big wave end, whether it be with the foils or board shape and locations and rescue and personal flotation. It's just, and training.
Yeah. I feel like the way you go into, like, you got all the boards and everything like that. Then you have a wave come along like Nazare that is like just so much different than what we've seen. And who knows what else is out there too. And I think that is such a cool thing, is that, you know, like how we approach waves depends on Mother Nature as well. It's not like you get to turn up and here's a half pipe for the Olympic gold medal and you just go and hit that run. You know what I mean? Like that run changes like instantly, you know, like, and it changes constantly, instantly. And, you know, and I think that's the beauty of it too, you know, is that, you know, the progression and the boards and the shape and the equipment is dictated by, you know, swell, the wave shape, wave type, you know, current wind, everything, you know, so it's just so unique.
And I think that goes back to the young guys just being on that crazy frantic program that we've been on for a long, have been on for a long time, of just like every swell, just hungry, boom, boom, another plane, another location, because that's the only way you can build enough experience and even have a chance at testing new equipment. It's impossible otherwise. So that's why I think I'm also kind of fine with like being more targeted now, is because like, all right, I laid a good foundation of experience. Like, I don't need to go and beat myself up getting on a plane every other week across the world. Like, I understand certain aspects. They're locked in. Yeah. It's my foundation. And I can improve on that. Whereas when you're young, you need to be exposed as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I'm going to finish off with a few questions here. But what's it look like? What's your mindset look like being a father now and having little Rella? I got asked that question. I'm sure it's like, has it changed? Has it just made you understand that the choices that you make have more consequence and just being ready? Or is it just like, hey, like, this is what I do. I love it. I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing because it's worked so far. Has it changed for you at all since being a dad?
Yeah, I think it has for sure. I think I'm going to take less unnecessary risk. That's for sure. I'm definitely going to be more honest with myself about like, am I feeling it today? So like, perfect example is last time we were talking and there's the Piahi event and then jump on that plane straight away and go to Surf Mavericks. I was like, if I'm going to be completely honest with myself right now, how tired I am, and then getting no sleep and then going and surfing all day, I'm going to be at 40% at best. Like, what kind of respect do I owe that place? And I know how much respect I owe that place, a lot. And it's a lot more than 40%. So that would be a decision that's definitely in line with being a father now.
Yeah. Good answer. I like it. I feel the exact same way. It's like, Is this necessary? Is this an ego decision, or is this a decision, fueling what's best for me and my family, you know? And it's hard to have those conversations with yourself, you know, because you're not used to it. But they do become easier and easier. And it's conversations in your head. It's just like when you become at ease with, and like you're saying earlier, it's like full FOMO. It's all it is. Mm-hmm. The fear of missing out. You know, like, once you're okay with going, like, you know what, I've surfed 20 of those swells and so what? It's okay. I got 8 hours sleep. I woke up. I feel really good right now. It's like.
Totally. But I think it also lends to the approach of being more targeted as well. Because now if you're really being as honest as you can with yourself about what your preparedness is at that point, if you've done the inventory personally, and you've made the decision that you are ready to do it, I think you have even more confidence because you're like, okay, I was super honest with myself.
Yeah.
I went through it. I'm ready. So it's like locked on. Okay. We're going down.
Yeah. Yeah. I made two horrible decisions last year. Both were done in Mavericks.
I like how you just said horrible decisions.
Oh, it was just like that. It was just like everything we talked about. I just did the opposite, but I learned.
I've done the opposite many times. Yeah.
I just was hoping that those, I wouldn't be saying that still to this day, but there's always another year to improve.
Exactly. It's a process, yeah, man. The only way you learn is by screwing it up yourself.
Yeah, well, I've done that plenty. But all right, I call it five to finish, five questions to finish. And you can elaborate as much or as least as you want. But the best big wave in the world.
Piahi. Yeah. Piahi's got to be the best. Yeah. There's still a lot of room for improvement. The velocity, the potential for the performance on it. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Heaviest, scariest, gnarliest big wave in the world.
Probably Cortez. Mm. Probably Cortez. Yeah. I think there's a couple of factors that differentiate it. I mean, Jaws hits so hard. But Cortez, you're 100 miles out to sea. So when you get pounded and blown in further on this giant bank where waves continue to reform, you're still lost at sea. If people don't find you, you're still 100 miles out to sea. And any size of wave could break there. If a fog bank rolls in and it stays until dark and nobody has grabbed you, you're in deep, deep, deep trouble. Like there, you just don't have those factors at the other places.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. I like it. We're both out there when the whole Greg thing happened. So we know firsthand.
Yeah. Remember that pickup when I got you, when we almost got teed off on, when you had your stand up paddle?
Stand up. Yeah.
Dude, that wave broke like on your calves.
Yeah. I remember you saying, someone said, what was the best part of your day? And you're like, it was picking up Jamie. It was like, it was the heaviest. And then you remember on the way home, it was a cool trip. I mean, whose boat?
Rob's.
Rob Brown's boat. Tiny boat. Yeah. It was me, you, Rusty, Pete Mel, and Sean Dollar last minute, and Glazer, on this tiny boat. And we went out and slept the night. We put a pop-up tent,
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And then on the way home, how glassy it was. Remember driving the ski back? It was like sheet, like butter, like a swimming pool. There's this cool photo of you like just sitting there on a jet ski and you could have just went as fast as you wanted. But that was a crazy trip. Shit.
Yeah,
what's one big wave you haven't surfed that you'd like to tick off the list?
There's a couple of those, and I'm not going to say where they're at.
I've had that answer before as well. Most underrated big wave in the world.
Most underrated big wave. Not going to say where that one is either.
I like it.
Outer reefs in Hawaii.
Yeah. The next big wave discovery, like I would say the next Nazare. What Nazare has done the last 5 to 6 years, where is that next wave?
That's hard to say because Nazare has a special factor in that it's close to airports. People can drive there. It's right there in front of you. So it can.
What about region? What about region? Where do you think the next region that or the potential?
I think South America has great potential still.
Yeah.
There's so much coastline in South America that is inaccessible by roads and
all
that jazz. Just logistically, it's a nightmare. And it's just going to be cold places.
Yeah.
Get closer to the storms.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. We're on, buddy. Hey, I'll let you get back to the family and go on to Home Depot.
Yay!
You're all right, man. Off the hook. Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, no problem. It's fun.
All right, mate. See ya.